Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. States are reopening and getting somewhat back to business as usual. At the same time, a lot of new information and often misinformation about the COVID-19 pandemic is circulating, just like the virus, especially on social media. To help provide for us tonight some clarity about the current status of COVID-19 and separate fact from fiction, I'm going to be joined tonight via Zoom on their computers, safely tucked away in their offices, still practicing responsible social distancing. We have Dr. Andrew Urochko, professor of microbiology and immunology here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine, Shreveport, as well as Dr. Jeremy Camille, associate professor of microbiology and immunology, also with LSU Health here in Shreveport. Dr. Urochko and Dr. Camille, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Well, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, so I guess like we were talking earlier, let's go ahead and officially call this the Mythbusters show of the COVID-19 pandemic, because it seems like with every new amount of information we get out there, we get an alternative fact or alternative explanation about, you know, is this true or is this false? And you may have some questions out there as well if you're listening to us tonight, and you can call with a question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Urochko, let's start with you. You know, now that we're, you know, opening up and, you know, we've gone into phase two from being in phase one with noticing a decrease in the number of cases in our state, does that mean that this thing's over?
No, unfortunately, it does not. I think we would all wish the virus would stop circulating, but it is still running rampant in the United States and really around the world. We see huge increases in South America, Africa. Numbers are still rising. Some parts of Asia, there are also some outbreaks. And I think you've seen in the news that there's, depends on which one you look at, anywhere between about 10 and 20 states where we see rising number of cases, including the three states around us, east and west, obviously nothing south of us, but it's definitely not going away. And it's definitely in some cases, numbers we see are rising, both the number of cases, number of hospitalizations as well.
You know, is it, you know, obviously we had limited testing early on, right? And so one of the things that people talk about is, you know, are we seeing increased numbers of cases because we're just looking for the virus more and the virus is really not as prevalent as it was initially based upon the number of, you know, deaths decreasing, number of hospitalizations stabilizing?
So, you know, that there is certainly some truth to the fact that as obviously you test more, you're going to find more. But just as an example, if a state did 10% more testing and finds 15% more cases, it does mean the case number is going up at a greater level than the testing. So that's just, again, a very, very simple, you know, example that cases are going up. But what would not account for increased testing would be hospitalization. So states where you're seeing hospitalization and obviously deaths, these are not due to testing, but due to, you know, unfortunately, it's an absolute in each of those cases. So sadly, there is increased viral spread under those conditions.
So some, as you mentioned, some of our neighboring states, such as Arkansas and Texas, are experiencing actually a rise in newly documented cases. So even in these states, is that as a result of increased testing as well? And what about Louisiana? Are we increasing in our numbers of positives due to increased testing availability, or is it increased spread of the virus?
To get to our state, we've got some data on our EVT lab that clearly shows our testing is going up and we're leveling off. So that, I think, is a very, very nice data showing that as we increase testing, we are not seeing testing. And it's, again, it's a good control that not every state you know, you don't have two lines going sort of skyward. The other states, certainly there's some increased testing, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I don't know if all three of the states, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas, what their levels of testing are. But I think the numbers, certainly there's some due to increased testing, but there's also absolutely due to increased spread of the virus. And so both are going on simultaneously. It is not just due to increased testing.
Excellent information. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. You're listening to Health Matters. We are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic, another special edition of Health Matters tonight. You can call with questions or comments and ask our panelists tonight. The number is 1-800-552-8502. Our guests tonight are Dr. Andrew Urochko, professor of microbiology and immunology, and Dr. Jeremy Camille, associate professor of microbiology and immunology, both here with LSU Health in Shreveport. Dr. Camille, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
You know, as we were discussing with Dr. Urochko, you know, the virus is still around. And as a virologist, an expert in microbiology, I know you understand how these things live and how they don't live, if you consider that, you know, living or not living. And so the hope has been that the warmer weather can reduce the spread of the virus. And I've heard a fair number of explanations for that, whether it's, you know, it doesn't tolerate heat well, or people are maybe just more indoors because things are colder in the winter and they're closer together. From what you understand of this virus and how it's constructed, what we're seeing in warmer weather, and has been warm here in the past week, does that explain any of the stabilization and viral transfer that we're seeing? Or in places like Arizona, for example, where the virus is really not going away, is that a theory that's debunked as we discuss some of the facts and non-facts about this virus?
Well, we'd all like it to be true that the seasons change and magically the virus goes away. That's a wonderful fairy tale that I wish we could assure your viewers was the case. Unfortunately, if you look at other parts of the world that are quite warm, like Brazil, where the infection rates are going so high out of control that the politicians there are having to cover up and just not even talk about the numbers anymore because it's so many deaths on their watch. I think the data really says that the big driver of this virus is the fact that our immune systems have not seen anything close enough to it yet. So we're pretty much sitting ducks when it lands in our throats or our noses. And it's true that hotter weather inactivates the virus if you're outside, but most of the spread doesn't happen if you're outside. The worst thing that I see is people congregating indoors, not wearing masks anymore, hanging out at a Mexican food restaurant or a crowded space, thinking that just because the government had to loosen the guidelines to keep us from going bankrupt as a nation and having economic collapse, which is a separate problem, that all of a sudden it's safe to dispense with the masks. So unfortunately, the spread's happening indoors in indoor spaces, and the sunlight and the weather doesn't matter so much in those contexts. Outside, sure, you know, you already go from a low chance of catching it outdoors where there's good ventilation to a lower chance even more because of the UV light and heat. But that's what I'd tell your viewers or your listeners.
You know, you bring up an excellent point regarding social distancing, and, you know, many of our communities are in the process of reopening. You mentioned the restaurant scenario. Obviously, a lot of people would like to go back to sporting events and go back to churches and go back to concerts. Is the need for social distancing over? And if not, you mentioned portals of entry. You mentioned the mouth and the nose. Dr. Urochko and I were speaking before the show started about, you know, a lot of times people may be wearing a mask, but, you know, pulling it up to talk or pulling it down because it's not very comfortable to breathe in, so to speak. So if you would talk to us a little bit about the importance of the mask and how to wear them appropriately, and should they be worn outside?
Well, it's a funny thing. I think people mean really well. You see some people on the far extreme of the spectrum. I've seen folks driving around alone in their car with a mask on, and I'm like, in my head, I'm like, hey, buddy, who are you protecting? You're not going to catch it inside your car driving alone. Or if you're in the car with your wife and kids who you live with, you don't need to be wearing a mask. But if you're crowding around people who you aren't ordinarily in daily contact with, and you're within less than 6 feet of them, especially indoors, I would be wearing a mask if you don't want to catch it. And the virus may not even hurt you, but the problem is you might catch it and go visit grandma, or visit, you know, you might bump into someone near you who's a diabetic or for whatever reason has high blood pressure, any other risk factor. And then you inadvertently become the vector for this virus, causing a tragedy, a death or a near death or a hospitalization that could have been prevented just by simply knowing a little bit about where your risks are. I mean, it'd be nice to go back to sporting events, and I think we can if we have enough testing. Right now, we don't have enough testing.
All right. We'll definitely get back to the testing piece of this puzzle. I've got a question that was sent in. I think somebody's ready for vacation. The question is it okay to go outside on a crowded beach, and should that vacationer wear a mask? So,
if you can smell someone's breath, you're in trouble, buddy. I would stay far enough away from someone's face that you're not breathing their breath, or notice that they've had a beer recently or a soft drink or whatever. If you're smelling their Mexican food, you're in primes. You're a sitting duck for this virus. But if you keep distant outside, you're safer. All else being equal, being outside safer than being inside if you're going to socially mix. But when you see those college people getting together at spring break, crowding on a beach, everyone's up, you know, teenagers are flirting, adults, grown-ups are flirting. It's not, if they're not wearing masks, they're in trouble.
Yeah, so potentially in your own cluster, as you mentioned, on the beach, but maybe a crowded pool or party situation where there's loud music, people have to be close to hear each other. Those are potential scenarios for spread.
Those are scenarios for spread. You can drop the potential.
Gotcha. Point well taken. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. This is Health Matters. We are listening to a special edition of this show regarding the COVID-19 pandemic. You can call us with questions or comments at 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Urochko, we've talked about, I think you were the first person to mention on this show, you know, the observation of the mortality associated with this virus. And, you know, some populations get a virulent form of the disease. And as you mentioned, some populations are healthy and they have significant sequelae or significant illness associated with the disease. Is there any information that this virus is changing in its pathogenicity? Is it as virulent today as it was when we first started to see cases in January and February?
So I there's no really appreciative changes in the genome that we can attribute. Obviously, the virus does mutate. I don't want to say it doesn't, but there's nothing yet that says it's losing virulence as it runs, because at this point there's no selective pressure one way or another. You heard from Dr. Camille, we're a naive population, so each of us if we were to get the virus is brand new. There's no selective pressure. Usually what happens, which we see with the flu and some of these others, that as we get a vaccine or we get the flu, that virus has to change to allow it to stay in the population. There's no pressure yet. So at this point, there is no evidence yet that it's lost any virulence. My suggestion would be with time, as with many of these coronaviruses, they might, but these are long-term evolution things in the term of years to maybe even longer. So, and that becomes difficult because we don't necessarily know when that will happen. So unfortunately, all the available evidence based on sort of the relative, what they're able to get case fatality rate shows it's about the same as it was in the January, February range when it started overseas, and then obviously March through now June here in the United States.
Are we finding that our treatments are working a little better as we've, you know, started to collect convalescent plasma, and we've started to use drugs like remdesivir and enroll patients in clinical trials like the nitric oxide trial? Are we finding that we're learning how to treat the virus a little better than we were able to initially?
So remdesivir as a product, obviously at the start, was not approved for treatment of patients COVID-19. It now is, and it's showing, you know, at least an efficacy in recovery of those, you know. So there's not good data that says it prevents necessarily death, but in those that would recover, the data seems to be pretty good that they have an enhanced recovery, seems to diminish perhaps viral load and, you know, some of that. So that's a positive. The convalescent serum, certainly the most cynical view, it's not harmful, but I think we all know that passive immunization, that is effectively what convalescent serum is a very efficacious treatment for many other type of infections or other elements. So I think there's positive there. The large trials are being done to tell us the level of efficacy. Certainly we've heard when Dr. Kevel was on with me, I don't remember, a month or so ago, talking about nitric oxide. So I think to answer your question, there are some treatments coming on that are improving outcome, but nothing is yet as a magic bullet that you get it, you know, bam, you take a drug, you take a shot, you take a pill, that you'll be fine. And that's, I think, really the scary part, that we don't have that magic bullet, either as a vaccine to prevent, some target to prevent infection, or to negate some aspect of disease. It's really, you get sick, these treatments are working, have a positive outcome, but yet, again, not a magic bullet.
In terms of the death rate associated with the virus, it's called the case fatality rate, right? In terms of,
correct,
you know, of the people who get the virus, are we finding anything new out about the case fatality rate as our testing has increased? Is it as, as severe in terms of death rate as we thought it was initially?
So, you know, if you look at some of the numbers that are available based on the U.S. and other countries where they've done tests per death, the numbers look really horrific, from 3 or 4% to some countries to 10, 11, 12%. Most people are guessing the number somewhere between probably about 0.4, 0.5 to 1.2. And I think the U.S., I can't remember CDC or Dr. Fauci's comments, their suggestions were probably, his guess was maybe 1.2 range, which, you know, sounds, that's pretty good, better than 5 or 6, but that's still 12 times worse than the flu, which has a general case fatality rate about 0.1%. Now, again, we won't really know all those numbers until months or years later as we get a broader range of testing, but I think those are realms that we should be thinking about. And really anything over 1% is telling us 1 in 100, you know, that's, I'm not sure I like those odds when you're thinking of, you know, the negative outcome and the potential for obviously mortality there. So yeah, it's a dangerous virus still. And like I said, numbers are probably somewhere around the 1% range.
Do we know what our rate is in Caddo Parish here locally in terms of case fatality rate?
The case fatality rate is probably gonna be a little bit higher than that, since we don't have all the testing we're doing still to be done by doctors. And so we're not testing yet the random population. So the rates are biased because there's sick people already. So the rates are much, much higher, 5, 6, 7%. And I don't have the newest numbers, but it's somewhere in that range. So we will get those rates probably down to, as we go through phase 2, phase 3 and are able to test sort of a random population, we'll really get a feeling for what level of spread it truly was. So, you know, again, based on our numbers, it's sort of frightening at some of those numbers that we see.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are continuing our special edition coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have a question about this problem, for one of our panelists. You can call at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Our panelists tonight are Dr. Andrew Urochko, professor of microbiology and immunology, as well as Dr. Jeremy Camille, associate professor of microbiology and immunology, both here with LSU in Shreveport. Dr. Camille, we were talking about masks earlier, and you gave some great answers to our mask question, so I'm going to ask you another one just to keep you sharp here. Someone's asking, they heard that maybe a mask can make you sick. Is it possible that breathing, obviously we have bacteria in our oropharynx, we have bacteria in our nasal passages, and are we going to concentrate microorganisms on the mask and then inhale them back in? Let's say, for example, I've got my N95 mask. I wore it all day at work because I, you know, want to be protective of myself and others at work, and I sit it down. And I come back tomorrow, and it's been there incubating bacteria from my nasopharynx and oropharynx overnight, and I come back and I put that same mask on tomorrow. Am I going to inhale pathogens and get a respiratory infection from my own mask?
I don't know, but if I'm going into, if I'm a cop in a SWAT team and I'm going out with a bulletproof vest on, am I going to be more worried about the bulletproof vest causing a fungal infection under my shirt, or am I more worried about the bullet that it's going to protect me from? I mean, is a seatbelt going to hurt you in a car accident because it's, you know, tight against your gut? Or are you more worried about hitting another car at 55 miles per hour and flying out the window? I think the relative risk rate is far in favor of wearing a mask.
Safe to assume maybe a clean mask is advisable, and maybe not reuse them.
I wouldn't
them
put your mask in the toilet before right. you use it, but a mask is going to be pretty durable. If you put it in a hot car, it's going to decontaminate itself. I really wouldn't put much worry on recycling the air that's touching a fabric surface that's coming out of my own nose. I mean, your body has amazing ways of defending itself against bacteria. We already live in very dirty, contaminated environments, if you think about it. So your own breath hurting you, I mean, think about where your breath is coming from. It's coming from yourself. So it's unlikely to, I mean, it may not smell good. You're certainly going to amplify your own bad breath and want to brush your teeth more often when you wear a mask. But I wouldn't be worried at all about the danger of breathing my own air a little closer. I'm wearing a mask when I'm indoors, crowded around other people who I'm in the middle of a pandemic, a historical 1 in 100 years pandemic. So I'm not really worried about my bad breath bacteria attacking me from the mask. I'm actually wearing the mask to protect myself from a pandemic virus that came, jumped into our species from bats or pangolins or whatever you want to say. And it really is doing a number on people's lungs. So that's why I wear a mask.
What about, you know, we talked about the ability for this virus in certain situations to be able to hang around things like doorknobs and washing our hands frequently. Do we know anything? Are there updated information regarding how durable the virus is on inanimate objects?
That is a phenomenally good question, because from the very beginning, there's been disparate or actually not so disparate CDC messaging, global messaging, that the responsible thing to do is wash your hands all the time, decontaminate all your surfaces. Some people are putting their like remote delivery groceries in the garage for 3 days with all the produce rotting before they feel safe opening a can of whatever got delivered. The greatest evidence is that this virus is predominantly spread by respiratory transmission, respiratory droplets, which doesn't mean that you're off scot-free and you shouldn't worry about surface contamination. If someone coughs on a doorknob and I touch it in the next 2 or 3 minutes after they touch, they cough on it, and then I touch my eye, I could catch the virus that way. So I wouldn't stop washing your hands. But if you're choosing where to spend your energy, I would really spend it being aware of, do I smell this person's breath and am I walking right close to them and talking to them? That's 90%, 85% of probably the transmissions. There's a lot of positive data from all over the world showing that, for instance, someone goes to a choir practice feeling a little unwell, but doesn't want to let her church down. She ends up infecting 28 people and two of them die. There aren't a lot of evidence yet of someone coughing on a doorknob and finding out that 5 or 7% of cases are caused by that. So it just becomes impractical to do those kind of studies carefully. However, I think we can be reasonably safe to know that 3 out of 4 cases or more are coming from respiratory transmission. And that doesn't mean stop washing your hands frequently and to stop worrying about that. But I would focus most on protecting myself from being close to someone else without a mask.
And, you know, being a virologist, I know you know about these spike proteins and how they attach to cells and things along those lines. So if I, let's say I touch that doorknob with my hand and then I, you know, reach for popcorn and eat it, and that hand goes into my mouth before I've had a chance to wash it. Is that effective transmission for this virus just in the, you know, from the skin into the oral cavity, or does it really need to be inhaled?
No responsible way I could answer that question, because I have my own personal beliefs that might be less scary than inhaling it, but I have no proof. So I wouldn't want to tell your listeners that they shouldn't be worried about that.
From the standpoint of testing, Dr. Urochko, you know, there was a mention earlier when we were talking about case fatality rate and testing rates and things along those lines. What are the criteria now, if they're the same or different, with regards to who should be tested for this virus, and what are the tests that we have available here in our community?
So the tests we have available through the EVT lab and certainly other labs there are two tests. One for the detection of the viral genome, the nasopharyngeal swab or saliva, testing for the actual presence of a virus that you may have being infected today. And then the second test is the antibody test for evidence of having been infected. Now, as far as all guidelines, we still have to follow the CDC and state guidelines for our outreach so we go to nursing homes. There's a physician in nursing homes. We have strike teams that go out to all the nursing homes in Caddo Parish in Region 7. There's a physician along doing that. We have permission to do each of the nursing homes. When our repurposed cancer center partners in wellness from the Feistwater Cancer Center van goes out to the various health centers, there is a physician or someone associated with that health center who is there essentially giving an okay for someone who feels unwell to be tested. We're unfortunately not yet able to just randomly test anybody. That's where we'd like to be headed so we can get a better feeling. And particularly as schools and things open up, that certainly will be something that will be very, very important for us to test a more random selection of the process. So that's where we're at. Those are the guidelines that we unfortunately still have to follow.
Great information. We have a robust caller response tonight, and we're going to go ahead and start to get to those calls. If you are on hold, we sincerely appreciate your patience, and we're going to start with those right now. Let's go to Dan from Shreveport. Dan, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for running this program. I enjoy it a lot. I have two questions. The first one is, what's the increased mortality risk for smokers versus non-smokers? I don't smoke, but my wife does smoke. And my second question is, since SARS was also a coronavirus, do you think there's any latent immunity in the general population to the corona-19 virus because of the earlier SARS epidemic? Those are my two questions.
Thanks, Dan.
To answer about smoking, I don't know whether all those tests have been done, but to answer your question, at least people with underlying pulmonary conditions and some of these other diseases, you know, asthma, do have a negative or comorbid risk factor. So presumably smoking in the context of lung damage would fit with the same ideas as pulmonary disease, asthma, with that, although I personally don't have those statistics, and I don't know if they've done a good enough study to really outline specifically the different risk factor, but I would be surprised if smoking was not a risk factor. And to answer your second question, since SARS, the first one was, it was also coronavirus, was very limited to only 800 and some deaths and only, 10,000 or so cases. It's unlikely that most people would, anyone else would have seen that. But you actually, if I can expand on your question, there is good data that there is potential cross-reactivity to the four benign coronaviruses, and how that might help is unclear. But speaking of a dad of several kids, I am hoping that is true, since my three kids have given me probably everything you could have ever had over the last 15 years. And I am sure I've had every coronavirus over and over again. So I'm hoping that I am one that, that has that. So in a succinct manner, there is evidence that there is some cross-reactivity immunologically if you have been infected with at least the four benign coronaviruses. So how that will regulate the outcome of an infection, whether it's less severe or that, is still unclear, but there's absolute evidence that there is an immune response to those others, and that it might help, and in some cases certainly does help. So I hope that answers your questions.
Dan, thank you so much. We're going to go to our next caller. We have Jerry from Shreveport. Jerry, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi, and my name is Jerry. I'm a dentist, or used to be a dentist anyway, and I used to work in the lab too. But what I heard that on one of the programs that cellular immunity was involved in this coronavirus thing. Is that true or not?
Dr. Camille?
Well, when you say cellular immunity, you mean T cells versus...
T cells versus B cells?
What do you mean by cellular immunity exactly?
Well, you know, like when you get a TB test, Tyne test, that's cellular immunity, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's, you're speaking, I think, generally of the adaptive immune response, which is mediated by B cells and T cells, both. And when immunologists, when I hear immunologists say cellular immunity, usually they mean cytotoxic T lymphocytes, which are kind of like, you know, a CIA force of your immune system. They know what the pathogen looks like, and they have a picture of it, and they look for any cell that has it in it, and they cause it to die. They just walk up, they poke a hole in its membrane, they have deep intel on the pathogen. That's how vaccines work. And then the other side of the adaptive immune response is your B cells that make antibodies. So both of those things are really important to control the coronavirus infection. I mean, the fact that convalescent sera seems to help people when it's transferred from someone who recovered from an infection, they transfer the antibodies from that person to someone who's suffering from the disease, and that person suffering from the disease gets better faster from that immune response that's transferred. Though that's B cell immune responses that are called antibodies. So both of those things are obviously probably important in controlling the coronavirus or conferring immunity. How long that immunity lasts is sort of a subject of debate and is unknown.
It was confusing to me. What's the EBT lab anyway? Is that environmental or biological? What's the EBT?
Emerging Viral Threat Lab.
Okay, thank you. So
it's brand new. It's brand new here. It was put up by an initiative set off by our governor, John Bel Edwards, and Dr. Urochko would probably like to tell you more about that because he was there at the very beginning.
Okay, I'll hang up then. Thanks.
Jerry, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. Let's go to Shelley from Jefferson, Texas. Shelley, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi, thank you. Just mentioned the lab there. I just wanted to say congratulations on that lab. It sounds like a real state-of-the-art thing, and it's really important that we have good testing, because I'm hearing that a lot of these testings out here aren't even correct, sometimes with the 80% failure rate. But that wasn't my question. My question really revolves around, I just want to ask Dr. Baracho and Dr. Camille, we're talking about the mask, and Dr. Camille, you just made a statement saying that like 90% of the transmissions is coming from just an airborne thing from that, and 3 out of 4 cases are showing those transmissions. I would really like to see that study because I haven't seen anything like that. And, you know, there's been some talk about the mask and whether, you know, these masks are effective or not and healthy or not. Just at a prior show, just prior to this one, they had a quote-unquote expert that's a staff writer from The New Yorker saying that for the cloth mask, it needs to be 12 or 16 layers thick to even be as effective as the surgical mask that we have. And brought up a really good point about surgical masks being charged. I have a real concern about these masks and how that's affecting our blood gases, how it's affecting our ability to breathe, because we do know that. But no, to my understanding, no studies have been done around that. It would be very, very easy to do. In fact, I would love to see Dr. Wissing or somebody out of LSU to do that. That would be really great. But, you know, what we do know about the respiratory transmission, the respiratory viruses, and RSV is a really good example because RSV actually is a lot like the coronavirus. They're both coronaviruses. They're both incredibly transmissible, but we really get that a lot more from the surface contaminants. And I find it really ironic when I see these stores that will say, you know, mask only, and everybody has to come in through the same door handle. And I would be willing to bet you money that if anybody got anything, they're going to get it from that door handle, because the droplets that the human body can produce is, they don't stay in the air that long. And the ones that do stay, because I've heard a statement about them staying in the air for up to 8 minutes. I'm familiar with like ultrasonic nebulizers. Those things can stay in the air for a long time because they have very little particles. But, you know, I would argue just even common sense, and especially science, that we're getting a lot of these infections through surface contaminants. And, you know, you're going to get it from your hands. I don't know of anything, you know, with the claim that was made about 90% of, you know, transmission being just through the particle thing. So was that a specific study that you read, or?
Well, I've been in contact with people from all over the world, amazingly through Twitter. It's if you follow the correct sources, the people who write the articles and do the big studies that come out, there's been an incredible amount of open science done in a very transparent way by incredibly competent and qualified individuals. And so if you listen, it's like tuning into the radio. You could tune into people who've been studying viruses for 30 years and listen to what they have to say, or you could tune into people who have, their own opinions about stuff, and they follow all kinds of sorts of colorful people around the world, and they have different opinions, and often they disagree with each other. But you raised a whole bunch of really high quality questions. I think in your question, in your and what you said, and it's clear you've been doing a lot of research. So I'm quite impressed at the breadth of quality questions you asked. One of them was about which type of masks. So talk about the number of layers of fabric you'd need. Well, there's an important distinction here. You have people who are treating patients. So you have physicians who are going into a nursing home that's full of sick people, and they're taking nasopharyngeal swabs. So they have to work in someone's face. Or if I'm a dentist and I'm taking care of patients who may or may not have the virus, I need a very high quality mask that's gonna protect me from the person who I know is infected or is very likely to be infected. Those are N95 masks, and we should save those for healthcare providers. Now, when you're at the grocery store or you're mixing with people for short periods of time, wearing a cloth mask, it's not gonna protect you from someone else. It's gonna help you protect others from yourself, because this one key quality of this virus, why it's so scary and why it's been such a big pandemic, is because there's a period of pre-symptomatic shedding. that happens always, almost always, before someone feels sick. And that's quite a big difference from the original SARS that came out in 2003. The people didn't get sick and feel sick until the same time when they became sick enough to transmit it to someone else. This virus flips that all around. People are spreading the virus before they even know they're sick. And that's called pre-symptomatic shedding. And there was some controversy this week with the WHO yet again making mistakes in how they communicate the risk to the public. So that's a couple points I thought I'd address for you. And the way that people know that most of the time this virus is shedding by respiratory is it's published even by our CDC in a report called the MMWR that comes out. It's the weekly morbidity and mortality report. And they have careful studies in there showing, hey, someone went to church, they sang in a choir, they didn't touch or shake hands or anything, but the singing clearly spread the virus all around the room, and 28 people or 54 people got sick, and so-and-so percentage of those ended up in the hospital, and I know two of them died. And then if you go to Korea or China or Europe, Germany is very particular. Germany is one of the most careful countries in terms of contact tracing, and Korea as well. They've all done a really good job. Singapore, Hong Kong, they're very careful about if they find a positive case, they trace down every person that positive person had been in contact with for the last 4 days. And they ask the people, hey, you came across so-and-so, do you recognize them? How long were you together? And they figure out from those interviews that it takes 10 to 12 minutes of close contact with another human to account for most of the cases. And now this can help them rule out surface transmission. Now, it's not the kind of ironclad data that you might like to see and that clearly needs to be done. I mean, we need more studies, we need more research, but there's already a lot of strong data arguing that surface contamination may be very important. And I don't think I would let your guard down at all. I wouldn't recommend that. But that said, I would be much more concerned about breathing in someone else's exhaled air, because we know there's tons of virus all over the respiratory tract. I mean, that's how we test for the virus, with a nasopharyngeal swab. I mean, you have tons of virus in people's mouth. You can ask Dr. Yurochko about the cycle threshold in PCR, basically how long it takes for the machine to show that it's positive. It's striking and scary how low those CT values are. A low CT value is like golf. Like a lower score means more virus. So this is like CT values of 8 or 9. Watch out. That person is going to easily infect. They have millions and millions of copies in any little drop of respiratory secretion. I would be very careful.
Excellent answer. And thank you so much for your question. And thank you for calling. This is Listeners Reported Red River Radio. We are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. You can call us with questions at 1-800-552-8502. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host. Our guests tonight are Dr. Andrew Yurochko, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, as well as Dr. Jeremy Camille, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, both with LSU Health here in Shreveport. Dr. Yurochko, you know, we've been discussing the Emerging Viral Threats Lab and testing. A few things that, you know, that have come up with regards to testing. One of the tests that seems to be more available now are the antibody tests, and what do the antibody tests mean? And then the second question that that is coming up is, what does a positive test result in an asymptomatic person mean, especially people who are retested beyond the 2-week sequestration period or quarantine and continue to test positive? Are there going to be persistent carriers of this virus, and what do the antibody tests mean? Are they specific? You mentioned that maybe coronavirus has cross protection. Does that mean a positive test indicates any coronavirus past infection, or are the antibody tests that we have now specific for this particular novel coronavirus?
So we have a fantastic antibody test that's highly selective, close to 100% for just the SARS coronavirus 2. It does not pick up the other coronavirus, benign SARS-1 or MERS. So if we get an antibody test positive, it says you have been exposed to SARS coronavirus 2, the current pandemic virus, you know, causative agent of COVID-19. It's also not only is it selective, it's highly specific. So in that context, we're not picking up others. But you're right, there was sort of a Wild West right when this first came out, with a number of companies making these tests with low specificity, had a lot of false positives. And that was really did a disservice for the testing. And as you can imagine, based on what we want, we knew that numbers would be low. Right now we're a little under 5% in Caddo Parish based on our testing. And you can't have a false positive rate of 5% if your numbers are only 5%. Because if you have a number of 5, is that really a 0 or is it a 5? Ours has very, very little, maybe 0.1 or so error. So whether it's 4.9 or 5.1, it doesn't really matter. So very, very effective. And this is what most of the tests are now. I can't speak for every company's tests that are doing that. Each person would have to figure that out based on what they're done. So what a positive test is simply going to indicate is that you have a detection of the antibody. A lot of the ones you're getting is a yes or no answer. You have the antibody, you don't have the antibody. From an immunological standpoint, we all hope that's a positive outcome and that's what antibodies do. You heard from Dr. Camille, I think you've heard me earlier today and on other ones, that's what antibodies are supposed to do. They bind to the virus, block the virus from doing, bad virus things. So one would hope that's the case. Our test also gives you a titer, so it's essentially how much of that particular antibody you have. And we do know that some patients, some of the antibody or sample we've got from people have very good titers, meaning they're probably very, very effective. Some are very low. Anyone who's had any vaccine, you go back to the physician, for the hepatitis B, since I work with human blood, I had to get the three-shot regimen 3 times, so 9 shots to get a sufficient titer. I don't know why. So that we knew that I was not getting a good antibody response. So in that context, that works, and that's what it tells you. If your question was an antibody test today, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, all the positives basically still mean that you have, of course, that antibodies remaining, and how long that may last is not known. I think you might have been, were you asking me also about the viral genome test and whether it's chronic shedders as well?
Right. The question was, we're hearing that there are some individuals who are testing, let's say they get a test for some reason and they're positive for the virus, not for antibodies, but for the virus. They quarantine and they retest. So they want to go back to work, for example, or, come out of quarantine. And they are still positive at 14 days. Is there an assumption there that they continue to shed virus, or is the test potentially picking up residual pieces of the virus? How do we deal with people who are persistent positives, and is that something that you're finding in the test that you're running? Or are people having trouble getting rid of the virus?
A very interesting question.
Like the HPV, for example, or other viruses that just hang around.
Right. So at this point, there's no evidence that this is truly a persistent virus, the way a herpes virus or some of these other hepatitis, papilloma you mentioned as well. There's no evidence this is a persistent virus in the same vein. And in most of the cases that have been reported, and there's no evidence it goes latent again, like some of these other viruses that hang around. Most of the cases where you're seeing a long-term sort of positive, it's usually if you probably were able to test them on day 1, day 2, day 3, day 14, you'd see a spike in the typical range of 3 to 8 days is when they're probably shedding. And near the end, there's probably, like you mentioned, remnants of virus. Our assays are so sensitive that you're probably right at the limit of detection. You detect it today, you may not detect it tomorrow, you may detect it the next day. And it's very, very unlikely that at that point they're shedding any appreciable virus. As Dr. Camille pointed out, we've seen people that have had more than probably 100 billion viral particles on equivalent head of a nasal pharyngeal swab. And if you only think you need 1,000 particles to infect someone, if that's a good number, that's 10 million, if I got my math right, people technically could be infected by simply the virus on the head of a swab. And obviously that's not counting every cough, every sneeze, every talk. So the people that are showing persistence genome, it's very, very low, unlikely they're shedding. Can't rule it out, of course, but it's very unlikely they're shedding in any appreciable manner. And like you said, it's very likely just remnants of virus.
Again, back to the recidivism for the virus. Are there any cases or is there any evidence yet that people can be reinfected with the virus? So let's say someone who's had the virus, they've recovered, they're going, Dr. Camille, if you can, you know, feel this one, is it possible that this virus can reinfect persons who have recovered? Do we have cases of that yet that have been proven?
Okay, I think this is one of the biggest questions and most important questions, but it's also a perfect teachable moment in how scientists communicate differently than media figures or politicians. So scientists will say things that aren't very impressive sounding to the public, like we have no evidence yet that infected people will be protected. Okay, we can't prove that this virus is not a special exception to every other coronavirus that's been studied. But the great data that comes out there, even from veterinary coronaviruses, is that when people are infected with the coronavirus, they enjoy an appreciable period of time ranging from maybe 1 to 3 years where they're protected from being reinfected by that same coronavirus. That's really good news for vaccines. So while we can't prove that this brand new coronavirus is not an exception, we have no reason to believe that that is the case. We have every reason to believe, and we have data now coming in that show that immune responses produced by people who recover from the infection, especially from people who get really sick, even elderly people who end up in the hospital for 5 weeks and then come out having recovered, the sicker you get, if you survive it, the stronger your serum usually is to protect other people if you donate your blood and allow a scientist or a physician to separate the antibodies. That becomes the most strong protective component that you can give to a sick person is from someone who was extra sick before they recovered. So we know that your immune response is likely to protect you from this virus, and that is a huge element to be hopeful about regarding vaccine development.
You know, with antibody testing, and either, you know, Dr. Camille or Dr. Yurochko, are we doing the studies that look at titers and the level of symptomatic, levels of illness that were present in persons who are being tested for antibodies? Let's say I go and get an antibody test and I was asymptomatic. Are they going to collect the data and ask me, you know, were you sick? Did you have a fever in the past 6 months? Blah, blah, blah. To assign my titer to the level of symptoms that I may or may not have had? Are we going to get that data?
We're working on that currently. Obviously, there's a human subject issue making sure we do that correctly. And we are working on getting all the approvals to collect that sort of information. We know the titers of every person that's given serum for us, and the idea is to exactly what you said. To get back to what Dr. Camille said, there's very good evidence that the sicker the person, they do have higher titers, and it's likely they simply had the virus longer, and your immune response saw lots and lots of virus particles, virus proteins. It generated a better response, but that's not an absolute, as there are very clear data that asymptomatic shedders can also generate high titer response. What's less clear in those cases is what's the T cell response and cell mediated in that context. But again, it's very likely that, as with other viruses, there's a good cell mediated response as well. And as Dr. Camille said, and what we struggle with is trying to learn how that will influence future infections. And you heard my little story as a dad of three kids, hoping that I got infected with every coronavirus and that there is cross-reactive, and that my T cells are in fact sort of prime to any coronavirus. And that again is the idea that you do have an immune response to these viruses.
You know, and it really actually begs the question, what do we do when we have a vaccine? Are we going to test everybody for antibodies and determine, well, you do or you don't need the vaccine based on whether or not you have antibodies, since we don't really even know if, you know, these native antibodies that we're detecting are protective?
I mean, my guess would really be they're just going to, anyone who wants the vaccine gets it. If you've seen it, great. If you haven't, okay. I mean, they are talking about making billions and billions of doses for truly a worldwide immunization. So I don't think they're going to be concerned. I think they're just going to load everyone up, give them the vaccine, and, you know, let's keep us all healthy.
Are there any risks of getting an adverse reaction to a vaccine if you've already had the illness? Virologically, let's say, for, you know, I know in certain populations, you guys do work on the herpes virus. You know, there are some controversies about the shingles vaccine, right? If you've had shingles, can the vaccine actually make you sick? So for people who have been asymptomatically, you know, in contact with COVID, will these theoretical risks be there when a vaccine is available?
You know, assuming the vaccine is safe, and with any vaccine, there's always, you know, that concern. But the fact that there's no risk from getting reinfected with any of the four benign coronaviruses would argue that, unlike dengue, which is a classic example, four species of dengue, if you've had one, get a different one, you get an antibody enhanced, really a negative outcome, is very, very dangerous, the hemorrhagic fever aspect. There's no evidence that I can think of that would suggest this, unless there's just something really wrong with the vaccine. So I think, you know, they're going to safety test these things. And again, there's nothing out there that would say it won't work. It's just a question of whether a specific vaccine, under the conditions that they generate, will it work, and that we won't really know until, you know, large human trials are done. And, you know, they've obviously got, you know, phase one and phase two, I guess, are underway now. We'll see how that turns out.
In my understanding, it's quite unlikely that it's going to be a live attenuated type of a vaccine anyway, right? And those are the ones that typically, you know, have the potential to cause the illnesses that maybe susceptible people get. This is more likely than not to be product, huh? Dr. Camille.
The Moderna vaccine, which is one of the ones on the inside track, is a mRNA vaccine, which means your own cells make the viral product, just like the virus would. It's not a live attenuated vaccine, but it provides some of the benefits, including robust immunity, that you get when your cells manufacture the viral proteins themselves, instead of someone, say, injecting you with some pickled viral antigens, which can also protect you. So you can, I think the guy who had the highest dose of the Moderna vaccine did have some negative consequences to it. But of course, they're testing from a normal amount, a very low amount, and then a 100 times higher than anyone's ever going to get, just so they have the data point from a real human being who volunteered to be in the trial. Hey, we're going to give you 10 times more than we're ever planning to give anyone, just to see what happens. And he's like, you know what, buddy, I felt bad, and I had some hives, and I got some allergic reaction. I was fine a day later, but it wasn't fun. And they're like, yeah, well, we kind of guessed that was going to happen. Thanks for participating in our trial. And so they aren't giving people the scary doses, but they do test them so that they know what range of responses you might see.
That's great information, and unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We had more stuff to get to, and we're going to get you guys back soon, and we're going to get to more of the COVID-19 next time. This is Dr. Randall Brewer. I've had with me tonight two excellent panelists, Dr. Andrew Urochko, professor of microbiology and immunology at LSU, as well as Dr. Jeremy Camille, associate professor of microbiology and immunology. This has been a production of Red River Radio. The producer tonight is Renee Moran. You can find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on our homepage. Thanks tonight to Mr. Kermit Poling and Wally Derleth for providing assistance. Views and opinions expressed on health matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This is KDAQ 89.9 FM Shreveport-Bossier, 90.7 KLSA Alexandria Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado Camden, Magnolia 88.9 KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton, Tyler Kilgore. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.